Valor, you've been involved in diving on shipwrecks in the Great Lakes for quite some time. How did you come to get involved in that sort of thing?
Well, I got involved because my dad was a Navy diver in World War II, and when he came back from the war, he started playing around with some early form of scuba gear, and many years later, when I was born, he got me into the sport. I owe him quite a lot.
What's the attraction of diving on a wreck as, say, just general diving?
Well, in the Great Lakes, obviously, we don't have pretty fishes to look at. If I live near an ocean, I might be a reef diver. But in the Great Lakes, really, the only thing we have to look at are shipwrecks. And when I started diving, I didn't really understand what I was looking at. I knew these were old vessels that had been lost, but it so intrigued me that I decided to become a studier of history so I could understand what I was diving on. And that's when the stories started coming to light.
If you had to pick a favorite wreck in the Great Lakes, which one would it be?
Golly, there are so many that are favorites for different reasons. Some are so intact, they're favorites. Some are so steeped in history, they become a favorite. But one of them that I really treasure diving on is the Lady Elgin. It was the worst disaster ever in the Great Lakes. And because of the nature of the sinking in a violent storm and with a collision, and because the vessel was not very staunchly built, it broke up literally into a million pieces that are scattered on the lake bottom for miles on the west side of Lake Michigan. But everything I see underwater is so entrenched in the history of this vessel and the history of our country at that time. For instance, I've seen muskets that were destined for the Civil War if the Lady Elgin hadn't sunk. And it really doesn't get any better than that.
What about more modern wrecks, if you will, from the 20th century, say?
An amazing discovery that we made a few years ago was a shipwreck off of South Haven. And we were looking for what we presumed would be a barge called the Hennepin. And when we got down there, the wreckage looked so much like a modern self-unloader that it prompted us to look into the history of this ship Hennepin that we had found. And as I started to study the history, I realized that this was the precursor for all the modern self-unloaders that still sail the lakes today. The Hennepin was built in the 1880s, but in the early 1900s, it had a conveyor belt installed on it. Really a kind of a simple idea to help unload the ship, but revolutionary because this ship prompted all kinds of shipbuilders to copy its design. And hence today we have the modern self-unloader that doesn't require manual labor to unload it. It's all done by machine. So it was a incredible revolutionary ship that we brought the story to light when we discovered the wreck.
Besides ships, there are also other things on the bottom of the lake, including airplanes. In fact, our local aviation museum here is in the process of restoring a World War II fighter plane that crashed into the lake during the 1940s. But you've been involved in the search for another much larger plane, a very famous airliner disappearance.
Very famous, yes. In 1950, Flight 2501, a passenger DC-4 run by Northwest Airlines, was leaving New York's LaGuardia Airport, heading ultimately to the West Coast to Seattle. And over Lake Michigan, it encountered a horrible storm, and it simply vanished. It took with it 58 individuals. This was, at the time, our country's worst aviation disaster. And the Navy and the Coast Guard, along with the Civil Aeronautics Board, the precursor to the NTSB today, mounted what was the largest search on Lake Michigan, trying to find the wreckage to figure out what happened to this plane. And they never were able to find the remains. And consequently, the government was never able to determine a cause for this accident. And so more than a half century later, our team became very interested in this, and coincidentally, so too did author and explorer Clive Cussler, a very famous writer. And he and our team teamed up to search for this. We've been looking now for 10 years. We have not yet found the remains of the plane, but my research, I believe, has helped us solve that mystery. In fact, I've recently released my new book, Fatal Crossing, which talks about this accident in quite detail, a tragic Michigan incident.
So you believe that you've at least got the general location of where the plane went down?
Well, no, we don't have the location, but in searching for the plane, we're looking at historical clues that might direct us to where the accident happened. Despite covering 600 square miles searching the lake bottom, we haven't found it, but the research that I've done has found literally hundreds of individuals, senior citizens now, that were related to people on the plane, who were involved in the search effort, who worked for the Northwest Airlines. And because of the combined interviews of these many hundreds of people, I really think I figured out what's happened to the plane. We haven't found the wreck, but we still know, because of that research, what happened. It shed incredible light on the accident that never was shed 63 years ago now.
Do you believe that it simply broke up in the air because of the storm, or was there some other problem?
Well, like any accident, I think there was a chain of errors. And I don't want to really give away the ending of my book, so to speak. I don't want to ruin it for readers who are now in the middle of it. But like any accident, a series of errors. And I've only, by talking to the individuals associated with this accident, been able to uncover that now, things that they weren't able to uncover, you know, weeks, months, years after the accident. Only after the passage of such a long amount of time has this information been able to come out.
Speaking of Great Lakes mysteries, archaeologists are still searching for the first European ship that entered the Great Lakes. In fact, it was built in the Great Lakes, the Griffin, by French explorers. Do you think that it'll ever be found?
I think there is certainly that possibility. Many of us would think that a ship gone missing now over 300 years might be simply broken up and may have come to shore, may have been salvaged hundreds of years ago for just scrap wood. However, a few years ago, a ship called the Ontario that sank in Lake Ontario in 1781 has been found. It's very intact. It's sitting in about 500 feet of water, and it's upright with masts and a crow's nest still in place. And that gave me hope that the Griffin, that's 100 years older than that, may still exist. But I think it was very irresponsible of the person who found a piece of wood sticking out of the bottom some 10 years ago now to claim that was the Griffin. It was a preposterous claim. That our team would never make such a preposterous claim. In the world of shipwreck, searching and discovery, you actually need to find a ship before you claim that you found a shipwreck. So yes, we are still waiting for someone perhaps to come around and find that wreck and solve that mystery. But like Flight 2501, sometimes things are not going to be found. They're simply too broken up, maybe buried in bottom sediments. These are mysteries that we'll just have to wait and see if we can solve them.
What responsibility do divers, including recreational divers, have to not damaging the historical record of wrecks that are on the bottom?
Good question. I've been diving for quite a while now, and when I started diving, it was all about seeing what you could find, seeing what you could bring to the surface, kind of bragging rights that you'd been down there. And what happened is a lot of the early divers stripped these shipwrecks bare. Well, in 1987, the government got involved and under Ronald Reagan's administration signed the Abandoned Shipwreck Act, which made it illegal for us divers to take things off a shipwreck. It essentially declared these shipwrecks underwater museums. And most divers over the last 26 years now have embraced that law as a way to protect these resources, not only for themselves, for their recreational pursuits, but for the study of history. So now we see divers preserving wrecks. We see divers bringing back video rather than artifacts. And it's been a real boost to this study of shipwrecks and to what we can learn from these treasured resources.
Even videos, though, can be controversial. Not so many years ago, someone sent a remote vehicle down to the Edmund Fitzgerald and took video, which included a video of some of the bodies that were still there, and that really upset the families. Is that a sensitive area sometimes?
Well, you're well studied up on these topics. In fact, there was such an uproar over showing video images of victims of the Edmund Fitzgerald that the Michigan state government enacted yet another law that said it's illegal for divers to shoot video and show it publicly of any victims of shipwreck incidents. I think that was a good decision. We should not try to profit off such tragedies like that.
Something else that's affected shipwrecks, I know, is environmental, and that is the issue that I think most people know about now, the zebra mussel. What kind of damage is that causing to shipwrecks?
The zebra mussels are a double-edged sword. They're filter-feeding organisms that were indigenous to Russia. They came over in the ballast tanks of Russian freighters in the late 70s. They started infiltrating the lakes, and by the 90s, we saw an amazing change. The water clarity improved tremendously. These organisms were filtering the water, but they were attaching to anything hard on the lake bottom. And, of course, that means shipwrecks. So what these mussels and now a derivative called the quagga mussel do is they literally cover shipwrecks like a coral reef. So now we can't see the detail. We can't see the markings. We can't see the wood grain. But we can often see the entire ship. And for divers, that gives us a real sense of comfort we didn't have before. It used to be that I would go down 70, 80, 90 feet, and it would be pitch black. It would be frightening. And now we can have ambient light and good clarity, sometimes down to 250 feet. I would pick clarity over being able to see the detail. It's a trade-off.
Is it possible to remove these organisms without damaging the wreck?
On occasion, trying to look for a name board or looking for manufacturers' markings on shipwrecks to identify them, we have brushed the mussels off. It doesn't really do any damage to the ship. What we've often found is paint and certain markings have come off already because of the action of the silt in the water. It's kind of like sandpaper. So no, I don't think brushing the mussels does any damage, but it's impossible to try to clean off a whole ship. We're lucky to clean off a patch of a couple of square feet to look at a detail.
On the 20th of August, you're going to be in Vicksburg, speaking at the invitation of the Vicksburg Historical Society about your work on Great Lakes shipwrecks. Will you be spotlighting anything in particular?
Well, I'll be talking about several shipwrecks that I consider legendary. I've pulled some topics out of my book called Lost and Found: Legendary Lake Michigan Shipwrecks, and I deemed these ships legendary not only because of the tragic circumstances of their loss, but also on what's been able to be learned from their discovery. All the ships that I'll talk about have been found and they've been studied. And through that study, we're able to basically write the final chapter of that ship, tell its last story, and show its significance in our Great Lakes maritime history. So I'm looking forward to being in Vicksburg.
We've been speaking with Valerie Van Heest of Holland, Michigan, who's a shipwreck explorer and author. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you.